All right. The rest of you, if you'd be so kind in joining me, we like to recognize that the Word of God is one of the primary places that God encounters us and makes His grace clear to us through the ordinary Word, just like these ordinary waters, just like this ordinary table. There are ways in which God gets His grace into us, and we like to recognize that by standing. So if you could please join me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize this together. And we're going to begin in chapter 12 of verse 1 this morning. It begins this way. The Lord had said to Abram, "Go. Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. I'll make you into a great nation, and I'll bless you, and I'll make your name great, and you'll be a blessing. And I'll bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the people on the earth will be blessed through you." So Abraham went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. And he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all his possessions that they had accumulated in the people that they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your children, to your offspring, I will give you this land." So he built a place of worship, an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him there. From there he went on toward the hill east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on his west and Ai on his east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. And then Abram set out and he continued toward the desert. He continued toward the Negev. These are the inspired words of God. You may be seated. I have learned as a parent, perhaps slowly, that's kind of my mode of learning, very slowly, that I have to be careful when I use the phrase, "I promise," especially with my children. Kids don't forget once you use that phrase. It doesn't matter, it could just be something simple. It could be, "Yeah, we're going to have ice cream tonight. I promise that." Or at the end of this day, after our hike, we're going to have s'mores. I promise this. We will do that. Or, you know, at the end of this week or the end of, you know, the day, we're going to watch a movie together. I promise. It doesn't matter how simple the promise is. It literally fills my children with unshakable expectation and like an anticipation. And if you've ever been a parent, how many of you have ever been a parent before? Okay, some of you. If you've ever been a parent, you know that it is impossible not to break them. Promises. It is impossible for many reasons not to break them. One, you're human, so you're bound to break some of them. The other is you can't foresee the future. I can't foresee the future. I know we planned that, but I didn't, you know, plan on the whole world shutting down, say, during the pandemic. There are certain things you cannot foresee as a human being and as a parent. So we are, as humans, bound to break some of even the simple promises we made. And the thing about my children in particular is their requests sometimes come like 8 months out. They'll be like 12 months out. They'll be like, "You know, I'm thinking about my birthday." It's like 12 months out. And they're so sophisticated. They know when to ask us. They know when we are weak. They know when we are tired. They know when I've just gotten done preaching that I'll say yes to anything because I'm in my own head. And Annie will actually say to me, "You can't just say yes to everything that they request just because you're not paying attention, you know?" And I'll just say, "Yeah, sure, that sounds great." And then sometime, literally months later, and it doesn't matter. It could be 8 months later. It could be 9 months later. It doesn't matter to these scrupulous enforcers. They will pounce, and then they will use those fatal words, "But you said so. You promised." Now, we all know my parenting skills are suspect, right? But even I know that once I've used an offhanded "I promise," if I were then to answer, "But I know I said that, but," I have failed, at least in my children's eye, at one of the highest levels of parenting. I have fallen, and I have not kept my promise. But here's the thing. Children literally hang their hopes on even the most offhanded promise of their parents, just like they build the scaffolding of their lives on some of the promises we make to our children. But it's not just children who hang on promises. Literally, the entire story of the Bible hangs on promises, are based on promises. The world of the Bible does this. The difference is the God who makes those promises also can keep them and does keep his promises, which is, by the way, a completely different world. That's a very different world than like a world where gods make promises but they don't necessarily keep them, or that's a very different world than a world where there are no gods who don't make any promises nor say keep them. Promises, and I have these promises in mind, God's promises kind of fall when we're in the category of promise in the Bible. They fall under the category of grace. They fall under the category of gift. And partly because they don't follow the logic. They don't follow the logic of cause and consequence. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some promises in the Bible that follow the laws of cause and consequence. Those aren't the ones I have in mind. I have in mind the promises that are given by God that don't follow that kind of logic. The logic that I have in mind is that these promises all rest on the one who made them, and they all rest on the one who actually can keep them, have the power and authority to keep these promises and to make them happen. And the God of this story, the Bible, does both of those. He makes promises, and he has the authority and power to keep them. He won't break his promises. And that's not just the backbone, by the way, of the Bible. That's the backbone of our entire reality. That is the scaffolding of our entire world. Why do I say that? Energy can't do that. There's at no point can energy assert that there's going to just be more, or that this is going to remain this way, or that this is going to continue. Primordial ooze, right? The primal matter has no ability to make a promise to you that this is going to continue as it is now, and then keep that promise. It just can't. Only God can do that. And the implications of this, I think, are quite massive, because if God isn't faithful to his promises, everything begins to unravel. Our understanding of time begins to unravel. Our sense of reality itself begins to unravel. Our lives begin to unravel, because the alternative to that is that nothing is stable. Nothing is guaranteed about reality, about how you experience it, about how I experience it. Nothing is underwriting this. Nothing is asserting that this is going to continue on in this way, and it makes no sense to even talk about the laws of the universe without also mentioning a law giver. The laws of nature could just unravel. There's no guaranteeing. There's nothing fundamentally underrating the laws of nature. They could just all of a sudden crash, right? The laws of logic, same thing. Miracles could happen. Not because there is a God, but because nothing makes any sense, right? There are no laws dictating anything. Everything could, I'm not saying they will, everything at this moment could collapse. Stars could fold in on themselves. Your breath could all of a sudden cease to exist. Your experience of this right now, you could walk out and there's no asphalt anymore. I mean, everything, nothing is guaranteeing that this is underwritten or stable. And to argue against that would be to assert some kind of knowledge of everything. You would have to have complete knowledge of the entire universe to assert that this thing that we are in is stable and that it's going to continue. The entire universe. Or at least you would have to have some information or a word from somebody who pretends they have that kind of knowledge of the entire universe and can assert that this thing that we are in is stable. But here's the thing, nobody has that. Nobody has total, complete knowledge of the entire universe. Now, there are people who pretend to, right? There are philosophers who sometimes, not all, but some pretend they have a God-eye view of the entire universe. There are even scientists, not all. Most scientists are pretty humble concerning what they can and cannot know, and they test those theories. But there are some scientists who can sometimes pretend they have a God-eye view and even claim the most preposterous things, like there is no God. Nobody can know that. Nobody can disprove it, but nobody can know whether there is or isn't a God for sure, not even a scientist. The only scientist who could claim that is if that scientist thought they were, well, God. Christians, though, can claim the stability of this place. Christians can claim the stability and the underwriting of this very existence that we are in. We can even and do have the ability to plan. Given our experience, time, we understand as Christians that time literally hangs on the promises of this God. Christians have the ability to claim that this place is stable. I don't just mean the present, I mean our future as well. Now, whether or not Christians actually do claim that, that's a whole other matter, because some Christians are too busy doom-scrolling on their phone, and it's as if they don't even read the story or even believe it, that God is underwriting all of this reality and guiding it, and actually it is heading somewhere and has a purpose and there is meaning to it. Meaning, it is very difficult to overstate or to exaggerate or to be hyperbolic concerning the importance of the promises of God and our understanding of reality and our understanding of this world and our understanding of our future. And the first major climax of these promises, notice I didn't say the first promise that is given, the first major climax of these promises is this story, the story of Abraham. It starts here, and it's to Abraham that God gives these promises in Genesis 12 through 17. And the first part of this drops like a bombshell, right? Because right after we encounter Abraham's family tree, which is Shem Terah, that's Abraham's father, Terah, we actually find out that he lived until he was 205 years old. And then after he was buried in the land of Haran, that's where he died. And so we know a little bit about Abraham's family, but without even a break. There's no break. If you read in the original Hebrew and Greek, there's no verses, there's no headings. It's all kind of smashed together in this way. There's literally no breath before you get to this next line. There's no break in this. We're just launched into something entirely new when God says to Abraham, go from your country, go from your people, go from everything that you know, go from your father's household to a land that, by the way, was occupied at the time, but to a land that I am going to show you. And in this sense, the world has never been the same since. Now, we know very little about Abraham before this moment. Unless you have a different Bible than I, we just don't have much to go on in terms of who this Abraham was. The clearest thing that we have comes to us at the end of Joshua and Joshua 24 concerning Abraham and his family. Long ago, your ancestors, your family, including, again, Abraham's dad, Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates River and worshipped other gods. Meaning, similar to Noah, he doesn't seem to have anything extraordinary about him. There's nothing extraordinary about Abraham, no extraordinary virtue, there's no extraordinary seriousness concerning who God is in his life. In fact, we're just told they served other gods. He doesn't seem to have any other gifts, any other thing that distinguishes him from anybody else on that side of the Euphrates, and God chooses him. Why? He just does. And I think this is what makes Genesis 12 so striking. It's a bit stunning, really, because it just happens. It's not like Abraham goes off to summer camp and all of a sudden starts taking God very, very serious, and like a genie, God starts showing up in Abraham's life. There wasn't a moment for Abraham that all of a sudden, you know, he got serious about God and then God got serious about him. In fact, Abraham's not even seeking God. We have no indication. God doesn't ask Abraham for permission to show up in his life. Literally, at least according to this story, God shows up in Abraham in his life out of nowhere. Or we could say, by sheer gift, by sheer promise, by sheer grace. It's often been argued that the threefold promises that are given to Abraham, and this would be the promise of the land that the Canaanites were in, the promise that I'm going to make your name great, make you into a great nation, and that you are going to be an entire blessing to the world around you and all nations around you. There's some indication from some scholars that those threefold promises really do give us the full arc of the rest of the Bible story, and there is some truth in that. But I also think we shouldn't miss that those threefold promises actually reverse the spiral of sin and death that we just went through to get here. They literally, you know, we see the sort of spillover effect that once Adam and Eve disregard God, it doesn't just stay within their personal lives, right? It spills over into all of society. We just came out of the Tower of Babel story. Literally, each promise that God gives to Abraham in this scene reverse everything we just saw happen in terms of the power of sin and death in the world, right? Whether it's, I'm going to make your name great. You're going to be a great nation. I'm going to do this. You're not going to make this name for yourself. That literally just reversed what we just saw, the curses of the Tower of Babel. Or even the land. I'm going to give you this land to you and your descendants, reverses the curse that we just saw in the flood story. Or even, you are going to be a blessing to the entire world, which is what Adam and Eve were essentially supposed to do, to bring glory and honor to God. So now, through Abraham, God is going to be a blessing through them to the whole world, is a reversal of all the curses that we read in Genesis 3. Now, has any of that taken place yet in Genesis 12? No. But in these verses, we have the clearest picture of where this is going. We have the clearest image at the beginning of Genesis, what God is going to do with this world, and that he hasn't given up on it. In fact, we have the clearest picture that he's going to overcome sin and death and its effects. Like Noah, in this story, Abraham is just told to go. And he goes. He does this without knowing even what the outcome is. He does this knowing there's other people in the land, which is no small matter, right? He doesn't know where a secure source of water is going to come from. He doesn't know if there's a secure source of food there, and that's pretty massive in the ancient world. He's not going there in a motorcade, like all protected with the right security, and nor is there a judicial system that's going to protect him in terms of laws of the land from losing everything that he has, and yet he still goes. And we're told nothing about what his emotions are. We're not told if he's anxious. We're not told if he's excited. We're not told if he's adventurous. We're not told if he's invigorated. We're not told if he's perplexed or stunned or just indignant. All we know is he went. All we know is he heard what God said and he goes. Or, in the language of Genesis 15, a little bit further, Abraham trusted God, and God credited it to him as being right with him, righteous. The New Testament gives no bones about what this means. I always say, you know, we read our Bible within Genesis here and in the context of what's going on, but we also have to keep the rest of the story in mind. And Romans actually tells us what we are to understand this to mean in terms of God crediting this to Abraham, this trust, as righteousness. And so in Romans 4, it goes this way. What does the Bible say? Abraham trusted God, and it was credited to him as holiness, righteousness, rightness with God. Now, to the one who works wages, they're not given to people as a gift, right? There's an obligation there. You have an employer and employee relationship. But when it comes to Abraham, this is what he's talking about. When it comes to Abraham, however, to the one who does not work, to the one who doesn't do anything but simply first trust in God, who justifies the ungodly, their trust is credited as righteousness. Why is this important? Why is that so critical to know about Abraham? What do we know about Abraham? He's not the wisest man in the shed. He's not the best man. He's not even a really good man all the time. We know this because his wife, Sarah, we think or understand her to be quite beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, on two separate occasions, he awkwardly and cynically tries to pass her off as his sister so that jealous men won't kill him in order to get access to her. Because that's what would happen if they found out he was married to her and they wanted her in this patriarchal society. They would have to kill Abraham first. So now, by saying, hey, she's my sister, the men know now that they have access to her. And could become their concubine, could become who God knows what, right? So in this master stroke of narcissistic selfishness, Abraham removes all of the protections from the very one he's supposed to protect in order to do what? Save himself. Rescue himself. And yet, despite that, we read in the Bible, Abraham still trusts God, and it's credited to him as holiness, righteousness. I bring that up because clearly Abraham is not right with God or credited righteousness because he's always, always in a state of trusting of this God. If he were always trusting this God, he wouldn't have done that. Just like clearly you and I. We are not right with God because our faith is unshakable at every moment, at every hour, at every moment of the day. No, the foundation of Abraham's story is the foundation of our story. Abraham acts at the beginning on the trust that God is going to keep his promises. And we've seen God make promises. We've seen him make promises to Adam. We've seen him make promises to Eve. And we've seen him make promises to Cain. We've seen these up to this point in this way. But it's not until Abraham that we have the clearest picture of somebody responding to those promises. We have a little bit with Noah, but we don't know what happens to Noah. This is like the first sort of story that we have of God showing up in somebody's life, like Abraham, and then we have this story of someone like Abraham responding to those promises, which is important, because is Abraham's response to God perfect? No. Not even close. Is Abraham's faith in God at all times and in every way perfect? Or steadfast? Not a chance. Clearly not. He wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have taken the protections away from his wife. And this is what I mean when I say this is what faith means. Faith doesn't mean that we're faithful. Faith means that God is. Faith means that God will keep his promises. And our response to that faithfulness has never been perfect. It wasn't perfect in Abraham's life. Just like if you were to walk into my life now and I were to walk into your life and we could observe one another, we could probably pick at a few things. I thought this person was secure in who God was. It seems like their security is in these other things, right? Your faith and your expression of your faith and trust is never going to be perfect all the time. And it wasn't with Abraham's, mine isn't either. And I think this is where we get this confused as Christians. I think sometimes we think what makes us different from the people out there, we'll just say, even though it's a crude way of putting it. I think what we think as Christians sometimes is what makes us different is our rock-solid faith, and they don't simply have any. That's not what makes us different from anybody else. What makes us different is we trust in his faithfulness, his promises. What matters is, yes, our response and our lives to his promises, but what matters is not ultimately our faith as much as our lives stand on his faithfulness, his promises, and our lives being lived from those places, from a God who not only makes these promises, but ultimately keeps them. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, we bless your name. And we praise you for taking this frequently unfaithful person, at sometimes, not always, but sometimes a person of very little faith, and yet you have seemed to still solve the world's problems through these promises that you alone can keep, and you do keep. Clearly, from even the beginning, the inklings, the start of this story to its end, this story is about your grace and your gift and your promises. God, we also thank you for the promise of the land and that place and space and matter, these things matter to you so much that you became matter yourself and that you have promised to redeem and to restore the physical, tangible world that we live in. Somehow different, somehow new, but God, we thank you that time and space and land and material matters to you. God, thank you for the promise that through this one family you created a birth canal for your son and that you didn't lie about it. And we thank you for your saving grace through that son, your son. God, thank you for the promise that the entire world is going to be blessed, that it's always been your plan to restore a family from all nations. Indeed, you've made Abraham the father of many nations, tribes, people, tongues, languages. And we praise you that your table is often bigger than ours. Your heart is definitely more measureless. Your generosity is beyond ours. And God, we thank you that you have made each of us a part of it, carriers of your story of redemption, so that by your Spirit we ask you to help us Help us to live not from our faithfulness to you. Help us to live from these promises, your faithfulness to us. And help us to love from that. Help us to love from your promises. In Jesus' name we pray with gratitude and all of God's people.